this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Angel of Optimism, Serial Entrepreneur Turned Investor, David Gardner Doesn't Write Checks, He Dives In Head First. And that's the cover story. The actual article is inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. Hardly a passive investor, David Gardner approaches angel projects like joint ventures. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. It's an unassuming suburban street in Cary, but tucked at the end of a hidden tree-lined driveway is David Gardner's $2.2 million mansion, overlooking a lake totally hidden from passers-by. The property used to be a fish hatchery, he says, motioning through the glass toward the water, tinted orange and yellow from the fall leaves. The transformation came in 2006 when Gardner's checks and vision brought what he calls the Big Brown Castle to life. He takes on investments the same way. While most of his peer investors look to serial entrepreneurs, those who have tasted exits and investor roadshows, Gardner prefers the uninitiated. He looks for entrepreneurs with raw material that can be fashioned into something bigger. 2 years into his investment strategy, he has poured about $7 million in 17 Triangle companies. For now, he has yet to see a dime in return. But Gardner is anything but uneasy. My slowest two are cash flow positive and growing steadily, Gardner says. When I tell people that, they are just shocked. No one believes me. They say that's statistically impossible. They also say it's too soon for the optimism. While Gardner has dabbled for a decade, he's been a full-time investor for just 2 years. There's a lot of time yet for investments to sour. Given that the self-described co-founder spends as much as 80 hours per week on his investments, some wonder how long he can sustain the mission. This week, he has three out-of-town meetings, in Atlanta, matching a company with the Home Depot, in Washington, D.C., talking to Gwen Stefani's people for a startup, at Figure Eight Island at his beach house for a weekend strategizing session with entrepreneurs. But I love it, he says. I've never felt so relevant or so appreciated. In 2015, Gardner may take on an entirely new venture, starting a $20 million fund to be co-managed with the likes of former Trinity Venture partners Alex Otsudinsky. Final numbers and details are still being crunched. For now, Gardner is focused on the 17 missions that require his immediate attention. No marketable skills. It started in the 80s when Gardner trekked from his hometown of Virginia Beach to seminary school at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest. I always say the best thing higher education did for me was left me with no marketable skills, he says. If no one will hire you, become an entrepreneur. He bought a suitcase-sized IBM computer to write his master's thesis in Greek, a machine that came with a thick instruction manual. By day, he was studying Nietzsche. By night, the computer manual. He was obsessed, creating a game that was accepted by a computer hobbyist magazine for distribution. That was when I realized I could actually make money from this, he says. Had he graduated with marketable skills, he says, he would have gotten a job, a mortgage. I never would have been an entrepreneur. But with tens of thousands in college loans, he needed a marketable obsession, so he followed his interest in computers to NC State University. He left a few credits shy of graduation, but with marketable skills. A side programming business became a computer store in a small Raleigh strip mall, and he spent the next 20 years founding software companies. Serial entrepreneur. When Gardner chronicles his exits from the first company he started in college, One Step Computer Systems, to his biggest endeavor, the firm that would become PeopleClick, certain words come up often. Luck, he says. Fortunate. Not every decision I made was the right one, but they led me here, he says. At $6 million in sales, One Step was sold, giving Gardner his first taste. From hardware, he pushed into software. I already saw that was where things were heading, with Report2Web, later sold to Redwood Technologies for $12 million. From there, Gardner moved to OnSphere, a custom software development services company that grew to 200 employees and developed the first online banking application for BB&T. A division of OnSphere became PeopleClick, which numbers-wise looks to be his biggest success story, though Gardner didn't personally get a blockbuster return when the company was acquired for $100 million in an all-cash deal. Gardner went on to work at DB Basics until it was acquired by New Horizons, later founding healthcare IT firm ProviderLink, which was purchased by CompuWare in a $12 million all-cash deal. Except for PeopleClick and my partnerships, I owned the majority of my companies when I exited, he says, pointing to his over 50% stake in ProviderLink, but shying from specifics. The Chronicle continues. In 2007, he managed platform technology sales for Icarus Studios. In 2009, he founded VenueGen, a 3D online meeting platform that raised $5 million in seed capital. Then I promised my wife I would never start another company, he says. I tell entrepreneurs I have to live vicariously through their experiences. Investment exploration. He wasn't a stranger to investing when he wrote his first big check. In addition to raising his own rounds, he eased into the angel world in 2000, joining Quantum Capital. It made a few investments, he says. It actually didn't do very well. He joined Tri-State Investment Group and RTP Capital. Through TIG, he invested in Morrisville-based Channel Advisor, writing his own follow-up checks. In all, he invested about $75,000 and eventually made about $500,000 as the e-commerce platform company went public. But something was gnawing at him through the process. Relevance. Scott Wingo didn't need me, Gardner says of Channel Advisor CEO. He was a serial entrepreneur. But down the road at Magnus Health, CEO Chaz Scarantino did. The UNC Chapel Hill graduate was developing a mobile healthcare technology and, like other young CEOs, was having regular coffee dates with Gardner to talk business. We would talk, I would review their contracts, he recalls. And gradually, Gardner started writing checks, eventually investing about $500,000, even bailing the company out when he predicted a cash flow problem. It was pretty exhilarating, he says. And he kept signing checks, next with Tilt, a feedback automation tool that aims to make teams more effective, then a brewery, Carrie's Fortnite Brewing Company, investments in Archive Social, Proctor Free, TUI, Validic, Glamona Collective, PhotoSwipe, Filter Easy, Ag Tech Inventures, Steels, Undercover Colors, Pack Purchase, CrowdTunes. The majority happened in the past 2 years. I never intended to be a professional investor, he says. I just started helping. If people wanted to meet with me and talk with me, I decided to help them. Focus on the triangle. It's difficult for Gardner to quantify his process, which begins with coffee dates and casual discussions. While many of his investment peers stick to Silicon Valley or Boston, or spread their southeastern investments in cities such as Atlanta and Washington, D.C., Gardner doesn't stray from the triangle, nor does he stick to one specific sector, counting a brewery and a chemistry startup among his investments. Most have some technology component to them, but I know it's 80% or more my decision about the entrepreneur, he says, and 100% whether he can move the needle. And with some estimates at a 90% failure rate for startups, Gardner wants as much control as possible. It's a shift from the piecemeal investing he was doing as part of a team. He uses Channel Advisor's Wingo as an example. Before Wingo started Channel Advisor, he co-founded AuctionRover.com, which was acquired by GoTo.com. Before that, he founded Stingray Software, acquired by RogueWave. With or without Gardner's investment crumbs, Wingo was going to get an exit, he says. I need to see how I personally am going to move that needle substantially, Gardner says. I want my money to make an impact. For a company like Channel Advisor, $30,000 would barely constitute a crumb. But for Undercover Colors, an NC State University spin-out developing a nail polish that changes colors when it hits a date rape drug, it buys both an influencing stake and a cache of research. I've bought $30,000 worth of date rape drugs. How often do you get to say that and not get dirty looks? He says with a laugh. The burnout risk. Jason Kaplan, co-founder of Durham Venture Capital Group, Bull City Venture Partners, says angels are an important part of the entrepreneurial equation in the Triangle, and they're growing. While angel groups were common years ago, he's seeing more individual angels, such as Gardner, step out of the woodwork and take bets on Triangle startups. But he sees risks with Gardner's approach. 95% of our companies have been that repeat successful entrepreneur, the Scott Wingo of the world, he says. Those people have been through a lot of different economic cycles. They know how to manage companies. They know how to manage problems. They know how to fundraise. While he thinks angels like Gardner are great, he questions whether a large portfolio with that level of commitment is sustainable in the long run. It will be interesting to see how that pace changes over time, he says. Can they provide the same level of support they provide today? Gardner's heard it before. He hears it from everyone. My model's just different, he says. He has a big believer in friend and fellow Cary resident, Alex Otsadinsky. Otsadinsky, an operating partner at Idea Fund Partners, also has a long technology career, running sales for AT&T's Unix products in Europe, and starting Sun Microsystems' marketing function in Europe. The Trinity Venture Partners veteran is in the early stages of planning a new venture capital fund with Gardner, with a working title of Co-Founders Capital. The discussions are early. They're gauging interest and talking to entrepreneurs and investors. It wouldn't be their only partnership. The pair both invested in air conditioner filter company, Filter Easy. There's something special here, he says. It's just not possible, right? How can you do 14 companies and have 14 work, many of them with big markups? Well, even Otsadinsky admits he's skeptical that his friend will keep that 100% win record, he's optimistic that there will be big wins in the bunch. It's early, but he hasn't had anything go south, he says. He's gotten significant markups and attracted solid financing for quite a few companies already. Otsadinsky is just the latest investor to come to Gardner's way of thinking. Power of persuasion. Global Software Incorporated founder Ron Kupferman met Gardner in 1998. David approached me, he says. He had a plan. He had a product that he needed some help to bring to market. He says, all we need for this is if you would put up $300,000. After raising $30 million, he really sold me on this idea, he says, and he really thought it would only be $300,000. I think he's had some experience since then. Kupferman was among those to profit from the PeopleClick deal. Gardner invests in the same way he used to innovate, Kupferman says. It's hard for him to not be involved in everything, he says. It's hard to just sit on the sidelines and just sit passively. He is what we call an active investor. It's an understatement. Gardner, who self-published a book, The Startup Hats, about his entrepreneurship strategy, doesn't have the time to relax by the pool or watch a movie in his custom home theater. Even his vacations, like this weekend's beach house session, are working vacations. Gardner strikes past the cello, I never play anymore, and past the server room he designed to maintain everything from lights to climate control, past the two yipping dogs vying for his attention, and the pub-style bar with a lake view, because as soon as this tour is over, he has another meeting. I really can't stop, he says. We go out and we close a big deal together, and they are so excited, I want a front row seat at that for as long as I can do it. And along with this article, there's also a small section on the side headlined A Gardner Sampling, a brief look at some of the most recent companies David Gardner is funding. Validic, developer of cloud-based digital health platform. Geomona Collective, technology-enabled fashion company. Photoswipe, photo-sharing technology company. Filter Easy, HVAC filter subscription service. AG Tech Inventures, agricultural technology accelerator. Steels, spelled STEALZ, developer of mobile-based loyalty card. Undercover Colors, chemistry startup developing a nail polish that detects date rape drugs. PAC Purchase connects homeowners with property services. And CrowdTunes, developer of digital jukebox technology. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The first headline, cross it off the bucket list, publish a book. Looks like well-known Triangle banking executive Cal Landis took to heart Nike Corporation's long-standing slogan, Just Do It. He just did it. Landis released his first book called The Little Book of Do. It chronicles his corporate journey through reflections of people who do things rather than just think or talk. The idea has been cooking in my head for the past 10 years, Landis tells Biz. The word do really separates success from anything less. Landis is known around this area for heading the former Centura Bank for 17 years and its successor entity, RBC Centura, for about 4 years. About 10 years ago, he started Plexus Capital, a private equity firm with offices in Charlotte and Raleigh. Washington, D.C.-based Lynx Corporation published the book, which costs about $18 hardcover. Landis has scheduled his first book signing event at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on December 5. Sloan inducted into Entrepreneur Hall of Fame. Raleigh entrepreneur and business leader O. Temple Sloan Jr. is among four honorees joining a very elite class as the newest inductees into the Carolinas Entrepreneur Hall of Fame. Sloan, 75, founder of Raleigh-based General Parts International that was sold to Advance Auto Parts in January, will be only the second living Triangle business leader to be inducted into the program that's sponsored by the McCall School of Business at Queen's University of Charlotte and the Entrepreneurial Leadership Circle. SAS co-founder and CEO Jim Goodnight of Kerry was an inductee in 2011. The Hall of Fame ceremony on November 20 was also a reunion for Sloan and his former Bank of America board colleague, Hugh McCall Jr., who was also inducted into the program. Wrapping Rex doctors promote urgent care clinics. It's not every day that local docs make a music video, but that's what some Rex healthcare docs did to make a point. Health insurer Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina estimates that 56% of all ER visits aren't warranted, wasting $38 billion per year and contributing to escalating health insurance premiums. Healthcare systems are encouraging patients to go to urgent care clinics, when appropriate, instead of emergency rooms. The Rex docs put that message to a wrap, including the chorus, O Rex Express, not as much stress. We get you in and out, and we charge you less. We're not too far, so when you get in your car, you sometimes should use us instead of ER. The video can be seen on YouTube. 'Tis the season for granting wishes. So far, about 18 women from the Triangle business community have signed on to be part of the second-ever Make-A-Wish Eastern North Carolina's Wish campaign. Women Inspiring Strength and Hope, that runs through the end of January. Co-chaired by Glick Tech's Chief People Officer, Diane Adams, and Trademark Property CEO, Billy Redman, these ladies will be competing to see who can raise the most money in support of Make-A-Wish Foundation's efforts to grant the wishes of children with life-threatening medical conditions. Last year, the Wish Women of the Year Award went to Joanne Pike, wife of Quintile CEO Tom Pike, who recently hosted a kickoff event for this year's campaign at their home in the Linville community in North Raleigh. And finally on this page in the You Said It section, readers' online comments to the Business Pulse question, is it time for retail employees to stop whining about working on Thanksgiving? From Karen Williams, it is just wrong to be open on Thanksgiving Day. I am boycotting companies that are doing this. Bobby Griffith, are you boycotting hospitals and prisons, etc., My husband works every holiday. It comes with the territory. If you don't like working holidays, get a new profession. And from Jim McMonagle, if people didn't shop so much, then the retailers would see no reason to open on holidays. If people felt strongly about this, they would stay home. It's a simple function of retailers meeting the demand. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal, and we start with the page for Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. The first headline, looking for a cheap place to live with good schools? Two of the first questions that any real estate agent will tell you that a potential buyer asks when considering a new home purchase, what is the price and what are the schools like? So based on those two important factors that buyers consider when investing in a home, a recent Reality Track report shows that the Raleigh-Cary market ranks among the best in the country. When Reality Track compared schools' test scores with the affordability of an average home, Raleigh had 8 zip code areas that ranked among the most affordable areas in the country that also had good schools. Raleigh trailed only Orlando, Florida on the list, which had 9. Statewide, North Carolina has 66 affordable zip codes with good schools, a number that is second only to New York's 105 affordable zip codes with good schools. And along with that article, there's a list headlined, Top-Ranked Triangle Zip Codes for House Affordability and Good Schools. Rank 18, zip code 27344 in the town of Siler City. House payment percentage of median income, 15.1%. Top-Ranked Elementary School, Chatham Charter. Rank 103, zip code 27592, Willow Spring, 19.7% house payment percentage of median income. Top-ranked elementary school, Willow Springs Elementary School. Rank 108, zip code 27616 in Raleigh. 19.7% house payment percentage of median income. And the top-ranked elementary school is Casa Esperanza Montessori. Rank 127, zip code 27502, Apex, 20.2%, Olive Chapel Elementary School. Number 135, 27540, Holly Springs, 20.5%, Holly Springs Elementary School. And number 148, 27519, Cary, 20.8%, Davis Drive Elementary School. Raleigh Times celebrates bar title with trip to Czech Republic. 10 bartenders, servers, and staff from the Raleigh Times Bar and Restaurant in downtown Raleigh have returned from the Czech Republic following a one-on-one tour and training experience with the makers of Pilsner Urquell beer. They celebrated with the Raleigh Street Party on November 15. The event was part of a Raleigh Times big win last summer for title of Keeper of the Craft by Draft Magazine. The Raleigh establishment, owned by Raleigh-based Empire Eats, beat 63 other craft beer bars in America for the title. The Ritz gets a makeover. Live Nation sinks $1 million into Raleigh Club. Concert promoter Live Nation has taken over management and control of the Ritz music venue off Six Forks Road in Raleigh and is in the midst of a $1 million renovation and makeover of the club facility. But the construction is taking a little longer than expected, and all shows previously booked through the end of the month have been moved to other venues in the area, says Morgan Nicholson, marketing coordinator for Live Nation Entertainment in Charlotte. The place was a bit rougher than we thought, Nicholson says. The renovated venue's first event will be the November 30 already sold-out show for English indie rock band The 1975. The Ritz will have capacity for about 2,000 to 2,100 people when it reopens, with an all-new HVAC system, new restrooms, and an added patio area for smokers. The venue had previously operated as a music and dance club as both the Ritz and Disco Rodeo under previous ownerships. Cary apartment complex sells for $45.6 million. Illinois investor buys second project in North Carolina. An Illinois apartment investor that's new to the region has paid $45.6 million for the Tradition at Stonewater apartment community in West Cary. Banner Apartments of Northbrook, Illinois, purchased the 351-unit Stonewater community from the Atlanta real estate investment firm Jamestown Properties, which had helped finance the development of the property in 2008. Tradition at Stonewater is Banner's second apartment community acquisition in North Carolina this year after purchasing its first in Charlotte last March. Banner's deal was financed with help from HFF, which assisted Banner in securing $29.66 million with a 7-year fixed-rate loan with Alliance Real Estate of America, Incorporated. Tradition at Stonewater was 93.4% leased at the time of the transaction, which equated to a sale price of $129,914 per apartment unit. Its units are renting for between $830 for a one-bedroom to $1,495 for a three-bedroom unit. The HFF debt placement team representing Banner included Matthew Schoenfeld, Jason Bond, Travis Anderson, and Ryan Clutter. Banner has also taken over property management of the Cary apartment site. Now we turn to the reporter page of Lauren K. Onosorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. The first article, Bowman, why Appia's $100 million sale to Mandalay Digital will be good for employees. It was 4 p.m. November 13 when Appia CEO Judd Bowman gathered his Durham colleagues together for the news. Appia was being acquired in a $100 million stock and debt deal by California tech firm Mandalay Digital. Employees were familiar with the name. Appia had been one of Mandalay's partners for months. The revenue from this partnership really started to pick up a few months ago, Bowman says. The numbers were so exciting for us that we wanted to be a part of it. Bowman, who will likely stay on in some capacity other than a promised board seat, we haven't figured that out, he says, will be a large stakeholder. Appia backers will own about one-third of the combined company, he says. So Bowman popped the champagne cork and employees toasted the news. A huge part of why Mandalay wants to acquire Appia is for the team, he says. Bowman sees the buy as a growth move. The Triangle has seen several exits over the years. Notables include ShareFile, bought by Citrix in 2011, and iContact, bought by Vocus in 2012. Those two examples had vastly different results. While Citrix is growing ShareFile's employee base from more than 80 to more than 600 and making big investments, such as the new four-story facility in downtown Raleigh, iContact announced 75 layoffs soon after its acquisition closed. Then there was Motra City, Bowman's first big headline. Bowman co-founded Pinpoint, which became Motra City, when it merged with Power by Hand in 2004. Bowman says this latest buy, however, will be a people-friendly exit. There's little in the way of duplicative roles, he says, adding that Mandalay, which is changing its name to Digital Turbine Media post-closure, plans to grow Appia, not just swallow it. What they had factored into their headcount plans next year was to hire a lot of the types of people Appia already has, he says. The move also means Mandalay's largest presence will be in Durham, which will have more employees than Mandalay's other U.S. offices, Los Angeles and Austin, combined. It gives Appia access to Mandalay's global offices in places such as Australia and Germany. A buyout has always been a better fit than an IPO, Bowman says. Right now, on the IPO market, you have to have, well, more than $100 million to go IPO, he says. And at $30 million in revenue, Appia wasn't there by itself, but now we're a third of a public company. Mandalay ended its latest quarter, September 30, with $5.5 million in net revenue. Should the deal go through, several stakeholders would stand to benefit. The woes comes to Raleigh. Always include the engineer in your thinking. Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, is obsessed with North Carolina. Well, he seems to be, having been the convocation speaker at Elon University, receiving an honorary degree at NC State University, and joining the board of directors at High Point University. Coincidence? He says, laughing. Wozniak, in Raleigh for the Internet Summit November 13, admits he does have a fondness for the state. I always tell people, go Wolfpack, he says. He calls North Carolina universities very close to my heart and offers advice to the entrepreneurs about to graduate. First of all, it's important that you have some income to pay for a house or family, he advises. Pay for your apartment. Get a job anywhere. But you know what? If you're going to work and you have some ideas and dreams of your own and wonder if they could ever be made into a product, work on them at night. And always include the engineer in your thinking, he says, perhaps speaking from experience. Don't think that the businessman alone is going to go very far, or the engineer alone is going to go very far, he says. It generally takes the talent of one person analyzing the business, who knows how to keep things running straight, and an engineer who has the clever ideas and can make the products work. Don't think, I'll write a business plan, I'll get funded as an entrepreneur, and maybe if I'm lucky and talk to 100 VCs, I'll get funded. That's a bad way of thinking. Be in it for the long haul, he advises. If you're like we were at Apple, you want a company that you think is going to go forever, that is going to be your life forever. I don't like that serial entrepreneur concept, he says. And now in an In His Words section, HCL begins hiring, poised to fill 1,100 more jobs in Cary. And the quote is, this is a long-term investment. We take it very seriously. Fresh off the plane from India, HCL's Senior Corporate Vice President and Chief Productivity and Competitiveness Officer, Rajiv Sodhi, cut the ribbon at the company's new Cary facility. The IT services company has hired 100 people since September and has more than 1,100 to go in its expansion plans. And in a He Said It section, it's exciting not to be just another fish in the sea of startups, but to have a chance to help shape this place as it grows. And that's from Aidan Cuniff, CEO and co-founder of Q Software, a startup developing an automation tool for developing mobile apps. The company just moved to Raleigh from Syracuse, New York. And then finally, under technology employment, top tech job sectors in North Carolina. North Carolina saw a tech job bounce in October, posting a 6.2% more technology jobs on average each day than they did in September. It comes out to 3,780 job postings a day, and here are the areas that had the most openings. Systems engineering support, IT management, software development, IT architects consultants, and IT sales and marketing. And now we turn to Jason DeBrun's page. He covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. And his main headline, Lipo Science Reveals Failed Attempts to Find Suitors. After Raleigh healthcare diagnostics developer Lipo Science agreed to sell to LabCorp at a price per share of less than half its all-time high, it contacted 14 other companies for potential bids, but none would even make an offer. On September 25, Lipo Science announced it agreed to sell to Burlington-based Laboratory Corporation of America for $5.25 per share, a deal with an enterprise value of $63 million. Shortly after executives announced the deal, certain shareholders filed lawsuits against the company and its board, alleging breach of fiduciary duties and the dissemination of allegedly incomplete or misleading information about the merger. In a settlement agreement, Lipo Science agreed to give more detail about the acquisition and talks both prior to and after the LabCorp signing. Before an August 4 Lipo Science board meeting, board members identified 40 companies to approach to solicit a potential acquisition offer. Those 40 were whittled down to the 8 most likely to make an offer. At that meeting, the board authorized management and Canaccord Genuity to contact those eight potential buyers. By August 14, five of the eight companies had declined interest, and the other three did not respond. LipoScience agreed to exclusive negotiations with LabCorp. After reaching an agreement with LabCorp, LipoScience entered a go-shop period and contacted 14 potential buyers, eight from earlier, along with six new companies. By October 19, the end of the go-shop period, 11 of the 14 declined interest, and the remaining three did not respond. LipoScience develops and markets a blood test that company executives say serves as a better predictor of a patient's risk of heart attack. However, health insurance companies, including Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and Aetna, would not cover the test at a favorable rate. This means patients who wanted the LipoScience test, called an NMR lipo profile, would have to pay a higher percentage out of pocket. Much of insurers' hesitance in covering the test stems from the American College of Cardiology, which does not recommend these kinds of tests. Some health insurers consider the test experimental and are therefore in a lower payment tier or not covered altogether. LipoScience held a special shareholder meeting on November 20 to vote on the LabCorp offer. The meeting concluded after press time. And under a section called Reorganization, Raleigh surgical device developer Boxano Surgical filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on November 13 and will sell its product lines through a court-supervised auction process. Shares of Boxano dropped 65% to 6 cents per share, and CEO Ken Reale said the company would delist from the NASDAQ exchange. The company's share price had not closed above $1 since April 16. Founded in 2000, Boxano designs and markets minimally invasive products to treat degenerative conditions of the spine affecting the lumbar region. Any sale of Boxano Surgical's products in connection with the bankruptcy case will be subject to bankruptcy court approval and could be subject to antitrust approval. And now we move on to the reporter page of Dawn Wallace. Wallace covers small business, personalities, and Triangle Trends. Her main article, Transit App Launches Tool for Providers. Durham-based TransLock focuses on improving the ride experience. Durham-based transit tracking company TransLock has a big year ahead. It hopes to impact the transit rider's experience by offering new data to transit agencies. The company's first product, released in January, was an app called TransLock Rider, which enables consumers to track a particular bus in its real time and see when it will arrive at the bus stop. Before releasing the app, the company was web-based. Triangle Transit was TransLock's first client. The company currently tracks more than 4,000 vehicles in the U.S. and Australia, serving 130 transit agencies. More than 825,000 people use the app, and according to TransLock Marketing Director John Mickey, 75% of those users access the mobile app every day. The company has been gathering data for 10 years from riders, buses, shuttles, commuter and light rails in cities such as San Jose, California, Columbia, South Carolina, and Memphis, Tennessee. Now it's shifting gears from the consumer side and plans to funnel the data into a new tool it is creating for transit agencies, which is scheduled to be released before the end of November. The tool, called TransLock Traveler, links anonymous rider data with real-time transit information to show agencies how their transit systems are used. Mickey says currently, transit systems know how many riders get on or off at a certain stop, but not much beyond that. There is no way currently to know where people came from to get on that stop, or how they got to their last stop. Did they transfer? Was it good or bad or inefficient? And where did they go past their last stop? Was it right next door or a mile away? TransLock Traveler will begin to provide the answers to these questions, allowing transit agencies to know what riders are using the system for and how to better address riders' needs. It's part of an overarching goal the company has to shift transit systems and the rider's experience to be more personal and tailored more to specific needs. And now we turn to our executive voice question and answer column. And in this edition, it's with Jim Hansen. Jim Hansen is his title is PNC Regional President. He's 36 years old with a wife and two kids. His first job was soccer referee. The headline on this column is Tar Heel Banker Returns Home. Jim Hansen poised to lead PNC's Triangle expansion efforts. And the question and answer column was written by Jason DeBrun. Jim Hansen took over as the top Raleigh area PNC executive earlier this year when Paula Freeland moved up to become the bank's regional president of the Philadelphia Southern New Jersey region. Hansen came to the Triangle from Birmingham, Alabama as regional president of Northern Alabama. He grew up in Winston-Salem and is a graduate of both NC State University and the Keenan Flagler School of Business at UNC Chapel Hill. When PNC acquired RBC, the bank did a lot to introduce itself to the community. How do you take that next step now that you're becoming established here? There is no magic change that is up my sleeve. It's the team, and they have done a good job. For me, it's a chance to be in a market I know well, one that I grew up in and am very committed to. There is so much opportunity in this market. We really have the trifecta. We are adding jobs, we've taken unemployment down, and we are growing per capita income. That means we have people coming. We are providing jobs and providing jobs that create more wealth. As a company, we know that's a very good thing, and we've got to continue to support it. Paula Freeland had a lot of respect in this community. How do you fill her shoes? You don't just jump in and fill shoes. I feel very fortunate that we had Paula in this role here. She did such a great job and was such an advocate for the community. The work she did taking the team through the transition was incredible. And I lived that in a different market, so there is a very healthy respect for what it takes. I think it's more continuing on what we're doing and going to phase two with what we're doing. How is your management style different from Paula's? Honestly, I haven't thought about it much. I haven't really sat and studied Paula's management style, so I don't know that I can really answer the question. We all approach the business and our company and the investment in a very similar way. The team has been doing a great job, so it's about how I continue to support them. Talk a little about small business lending. How can small business owners access capital? This has been a significant area of growth for us. We've put more business bankers throughout the market, which cover the small business owner. We are really investing in educating our branch and business banking teams. It's on us that we have to get out and meet the needs of the community. There's another piece as well. We want to partner with small business owners, offer them products to help with things like cash flow management, or give them the technology they need to manage their accounts or warn against overdrafting. You have the PNC name on the arena where the Hurricanes and Wolfpack play. That's certainly a point of pride, but also comes at a cost of $4 million per year. Talk about the strategy behind that investment. It's a cash commitment, but at the same time, it is an investment. I don't think there is a magic return on investment formula, but it shows our commitment to the area. And it's branding. You know, at the same time, we have our name on the tallest building in downtown Raleigh on Fayetteville Street. I think these are all investments in what we're doing here in the community. It's nice to have. I'm looking forward to going to games. Also, it's not just a name on the building, but it's how we continue to invest in those partners. That includes giveaways with the Hurricanes or when we partner with the Wolfpack game. You have degrees from both NC State undergraduate and UNC Chapel Hill graduate. How do you work through that internal struggle when choosing a team to cheer for? I'm a Wolfpacker at heart. At the same time, the education in Chapel Hill and connections there are great. Coming from Birmingham, I used to tell people, imagine if Auburn and Alabama were 20 miles from each other and right by Birmingham. That's what it's like living in Raleigh. What keeps you up at night? First, personally, we are in the middle of a transition for our children, moving from Birmingham. I am fortunate to have a good family, so just making sure they are in a good spot. I should say, so far, the transition has been amazing. Professionally, it's all good things. It's excitement for the new role. We have a great team and a great company, so you feel pressure to live up to that, so making sure we are supporting the team and living up to them. What's it like being a banker? Is there a stigma you face at dinner parties? I think our industry and our company is focused on what we do on Main Street, what we are doing every day in the community. We've tripled in size in the past 7 years, including with acquisitions. We continue to make investments in technology. If you take care of clients and you grow the business, it all works out. You've mentioned technology several times. Has that been a particular focus? Our business as a whole is shifting. 82% of interactions now are by ATM or by phone. Less than 2 years ago, mobile deposits made up 20% of all deposits. Now it's 45%. We are a technology company in many ways. It started as a need to serve one generation coming, but having to think about maintaining the other generations has also changed. Take our retired parents, for example. Many of them have smartphones too, so they can just download the app and take a picture of the check. It's becoming where all generations are reaching that point. We've known that, and we've been investing in virtual wallet and other products around that will continue to receive investments. What's your favorite smartphone app, besides the PNC app, of course? Pandora Music or Twitter for news? I start my morning and follow Economist, Financial Times, Business Insider, and plow through news that way. Twitter has become my main entry point to news. As for music, I don't necessarily have a favorite channel. I listen to a pretty wide variety. What did you want to be when you were 10 years old? A pediatrician. And now we turn to the viewpoint page. First, we have the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee. The headline, Uber needs to make a U-turn to steady the car. Being confident, decisive, cocky, and even arrogant often works for entrepreneurs when they know the country loves what they have to offer. It looks like the leadership at Uber has taken those attributes to a whole new level. The ride-sharing company, which could hit $10 billion in revenue by 2015 by some estimates, has been in the news recently, and mainly for the wrong reasons. News leaked out that an executive floated the idea of investigating journalists who criticized the company's policies and procedures. Also, we heard about individuals who are being tracked by company officials regarding their whereabouts, a violation of the company's privacy policies. So now the company comes out and says that employees should not have done that. Management is sorry it happened, and new rules are put in place. Uber takes to Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and all other social channels and begs for forgiveness. And it blows over, right? Not so fast. Based on some of the statements these executives have made in the past year, there seems to be a lack of workplace culture at Uber. True, it takes years to develop a corporate culture where employees are well aware of how to act when interacting with customers, how to act in the office, how to act at meetings, and perhaps most importantly, how to act when performing the job. These self-inflicted wounds suggest much of that is missing, primarily because the outfit is growing so fast. Uber is a disruptor, and frankly, it is fantastic news for consumers to have tech companies such as Uber and Lyft gain traction because it is beginning to turn the traditional taxi service on its head. But like anything, new technology will test prevailing rules and regulations. Legislators across the country are grappling with the issue of how to regulate ride-sharing services so it levels the playing field for taxi, limousine, and fleet services. Charting this treacherous course should be enough to keep Uber CEO Travis Kalanick busy, but when some of the company's top executives are viewed as reckless cowboys, Uber's whole business model may collapse under its own arrogance. So, is Uber the prototype of the ride-sharing industry, essentially the 1.0 version, only to be overtaken by a similar tech outfit that develops a better mousetrap? Or does Uber want to lead the segment with innovation, governance, and an honorable culture? The answer lies in the actions of the company in the next few months. In the end, Uber has reiterated that one should not mess with the old adage, customers come first. And staying on the viewpoint page, here's the letter to the editor. It's written by Sharon Allred Decker, who is North Carolina's Commerce Secretary. The headline, Here's the Truth About JDIG Incentives. In the November 14 edition, I read with concern an editorial entitled, The Money Game We Play to Lure Jobs. In my role as Secretary of Commerce for nearly 2 years now, I have come to better understand a number of important realities in the work of encouraging new companies to locate in the state and helping existing companies expand. North Carolina has many important attributes that make it a location companies consistently consider, from the market access available due to our mid-Atlantic location and sound transportation infrastructure, to the availability of productive and talented workers, to our strong university and community college systems, to our low state and local tax burdens, utility rates, and other costs of doing business. Companies regularly make decisions to locate or expand in our state based on these factors alone. But I've also learned that companies today have global choices, whether it be in China, Germany, Mexico, or closer to home in another southeastern U.S. state. It is in these competitive situations where we employ the state's financial incentive tools, and in my experience, they do make a difference. What has been difficult for me to understand since being appointed secretary is the level of misunderstanding that exists regarding the state's incentive tools, especially the state's flagship program, the Job Development Investment Grant, JDIG. Created in 2003, the JDIG program is effective, performance-based, necessary, and transparent. North Carolina has effectively used this program to attract new and existing business. Companies like Sturm Ruger, Gildan Yarns, RC Creations, GKN Driveline, and Richelieu Hosiery are providing transformational employment opportunities in rural areas. Companies such as Electrolux, HCL, and Sealed Air have plans to establish major headquarters, R&D, and operational functions in the state. It is also important to note that any time a grant is made in an urban community, a portion of the grant is transferred to a fund in the Department of Commerce dedicated to providing public infrastructure support to rural areas for future development opportunities. The JDIG grants are performance-based, so a company must commit to job, wage, and investment requirements as part of its grant agreement. Only after the Departments of Commerce and Revenue verify the company has met its commitments and paid the withholding taxes associated with the new positions in the company, is the company eligible for a payment. Simply put, if a company does not create the required number of jobs, it does not receive the money. The JDIG program has received national recognition for its transparency. In 2012, the Pew Center for the Public Interest analyzed incentive policies in the U.S. and named North Carolina one of 13 states leading the way in generating much-needed answers about tax incentives' effectiveness. A 2014 report by Good Jobs First ranked North Carolina number 3 among the 50 states in terms of transparency of job creation incentive programs. The JDIG program also includes important controls to ensure there is a positive return on investment. Decisions are made by a 5-member panel that includes top executive branch appointees and 2 appointees from the North Carolina General Assembly. There are dollar caps on the amount of authorized awards to ensure greater budgetary certainty. The state dollars associated with the JDIG program are dollars that would not have been available to the state without the state's award of the grant and the company's acceptance of the grant's requirements. There is no loss of existing revenues. In fact, over the life of the program, the state has received 2.5 times the amount of new revenue that it has invested in companies that have met all the necessary grant requirements. The JDIG program is not the only tool in North Carolina's toolbox, but it is an important one. With a better understanding of the way it is used and the sound policy guidelines that ensure its efficiency, I believe the North Carolina General Assembly will once again see the benefit of making this tool available to encourage the creation of job opportunities for citizens across the state of North Carolina. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the People on the Move section, the spotlight, that is on Brian Didiano, Vice President at Danis Construction. With a position that he says offered him an opportunity to provide operations leadership at an executive level, Brian Didiano is ready to hit the ground running at his new employer, Danis Construction. As a vice president of the company, Didiano now oversees office operations and field management staff for the Triangle market. He will also work on developing strategic partnerships for future work in various market sectors, including corporate, healthcare, higher education, and mission-critical projects. Danis Construction Company is a general contracting company based in Dayton, Ohio. The firm employs a total of 389 full-time workers, 38 of whom are located in the Triangle. What is one thing you wish people knew about your job? I wish people knew that my job is fun. I work with a great group of professionals who work collaboratively with a common purpose, to become the benchmark of contractors that others are compared to. I look forward to going to work every day in such a great team environment. Goals. My first major goal will be to focus on improving internally. We are a great construction company, and I want to help make us even better. In order to become a best-in-class construction company in North Carolina, we need to continue to strive for excellence. In doing so, I want our employees in North Carolina to view our company as a family, one that takes pride in its work, works hard, and enjoys the benefits of its labor. Biggest pet peeve? My biggest pet peeve is being lazy. I grew up having very little and utilized hard work to achieve my goals. Biggest worry? I have an 8-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son. The teenage years are coming. A Triangle business person you most admire? If I had to name one person, it would be Tick Clancy. Tick is a leader who cares for his employees like family, works hard every day, and is one of the most fair and ethical businessmen I know. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for this episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.